Hey, Trailblazers, this is Jason, your host of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. Before we jump into our latest episode, I've got some incredible news for you. Are you gearing up for your next big hike or backpacking trip? Well, we at Trailblazing Texas podcast have partnered up with Trekker Joe's, the ultimate Texas outfitter, to bring you something I feel absolutely special. Listeners, you of the Trailblazing Texas podcast can now get a one-time 15% off their gear purchases at Trekker Joe's. That's right. Whether you're a first-time customer at Trekker Joe's or a repeat customer like me, you can save big and hit the trails well-prepared. So upon checkout, use code TTP15 to claim your 15% discount and, in the process, support an amazing local Texas business. So happy trails, and don't forget to tell your hiking buddies. Now on with the episode. Welcome to the Trailblazing Texas podcast, where we embark on a journey through our diverse Texas landscapes and breathtaking trails while always engaging with our amazing Texas hiking community. So settle in, tighten up those bootlaces, and get ready for the thrilling tales awaiting for you on this episode. All right, so what's the scariest weather shift you've ever experienced while guiding, or really, I mean, it could even be just in the mountains in general? And the reason why I ask is when I started doing a lot of research, you know, wanting to, I don't know why I got the bug of doing 14ers in Colorado, 13ers and 12-teeners, if that's even a word, you know, they're just as exciting and dangerous. But it was the 14ers, and, you know, you always hear that you want to be heading back down or in, you know, below tree line before noon because of the thunderstorms. What you're doing, I'm sure you're worried a lot more about, you know, other things than just thunderstorms, that there's a whole
slew of other things that can go. You know, thunderstorms in the mountains are definitely a big concern for mostly for the guides and climbers that are out in like the Rockies, though. It's more of like a Rocky Mountain, kind of an intermountain continental type of issue. It's not typically an issue. It's certainly not a common occurrence to have an afternoon thunderstorm in the Cascades. It does happen, but it's not like it's by no means like a routine thing here. So for me, it's really, you know, when I do travel and work or climb in, you know, like the Sierra or the Rockies, I do focus on those things for sure. But here in Washington, the main thing is just that, you know, like a forecast, a weather forecast is pretty accurate nowadays, right? Like the days of like surprise storms, you know, that aren't even close to forecasted correctly, they're not like completely behind us, but models have gotten quite a bit better, right? So like I trust a 3-day forecast pretty well. You know, things definitely change, but you kind of have an idea of what you're going to be dealing with. However, on the volcanoes particularly, I think the weather models kind of struggle with such an extreme amount of orographic lifting. So essentially orographic lifting is like where weather is being pushed up into the, different layers from down lower are being pushed higher into the upper atmosphere because there's a mountain in the way and it needs to either go around it or up and over it. And so you do get weather forecasts that are pretty wonky when you're on a big volcano, a standalone, you know, 7,000 foot volcano. And when I say 7,000 feet, I mean like 7,000 feet of relief. So the surrounding terrain is 7,000 feet below. It's just such an isolated anomaly that you get that. But, you know, for me, the one that comes to mind is I was guiding an overnight climb with a freshly married honeymoon couple. They were literally on their honeymoon. Yeah. And I even told them, I was like, hey, guys, like the weather doesn't look good. It looks reasonable for us to like go up and like have a camping trip in a beautiful place, but like we're probably not going to summit. And, you know, it could be kind of rough, right? Like I was like, it is your honeymoon. I would totally understand if you want to just like scrap the trip, you know. I'd take a pay cut in that situation, but like, I was like, hey guys, you know, what do you think? What do you want to do? And they're like, oh, we want to just go for it. How bad can it be? You know, we want the experience. And so
how bad can it be?
Yeah. The classic. Right. And, it was really bad. Like so incredibly bad actually that, it was snowing. It was like late June. Actually, I think it might've been early June, but it was snowing really badly. And, I was in a small 2-person tent on my own. They were in like a more, robust, 3-person mountaineering tent, proper tent for the conditions. But the snow was piling up on our tents at such a rate that I was getting kind of concerned that I would essentially asphyxiate in my tent because it was being buried. So I set an alarm to go off for every hour. So I would just like lay in bed for an hour, try and get a little bit of sleep, and then my alarm would go off and wake me up, and I would open up my tent and essentially go outside and dig out my tent, which definitely needed to be dug out. And I'd dig out my client's tent a little bit, and then finally at like 5 o'clock in the morning, I just gave up on my tent. I just abandoned it and slept in between. Like they let me into their tent, and I don't know why, but they were just like, it just worked out that I was just like in between this honeymooning couple in their tent. Sleep, you know, it was just so bad. And then we woke up in the morning and like it was still pretty bad, so we like packed it all up and went down. But they ended up traveling around and, you know, exploring the sites, and I'm sure they have a great story, you know, from it, but pretty bad. Yeah.
Wow. So have you ever had to perform an emergency descent?
I guess not really like super crazy emergency. The one that comes to mind really, that was actually kind of recent. It was actually last season. There was a gentleman that I was guiding that had chest pains, bad, sudden onset chest pain, you know, with exertion. Right. And so I was like, you know, I think he was in his like late 40s, early 50s. And I was like, we need to go down for sure. And so I like kind of let the office know what I was dealing with. You know, we kind of like put the, you know, the next steps in the process of like contacting outside help on like standby. And it ended up resolving once we got back down to camp, and he went and got checked out and everything was actually okay. But yeah, that was kind of an alarming.
So if you kind of look at your tool bag of skills, what is one skill that you think maybe that's more important than others, or that I guess they all can play a part in saving your life, but that, you know, what is there that one skill that you think is important for mountaineering?
I think just honestly, it's not really like a technical skill. It's just the ability to stay calm under pressure. And a lot of that is tested in the certification process. You know, it's like kind of a big component of it is how you like manage stress. But I've always actually found a weird thing with me is that like the more stressful the actual situation is, the almost like calmer I become. And then like if something's not very stressful and I've got like too much time to think about things and, you know, it's like not that stressful, I'm actually kind of anxious. You know, it's like I'm like a backwards person in that way. But yeah, I would just say it's your ability to remain cool under pressure.
That kind of translates across mountaineering, as you've said, and also hiking and backpacking. When you get into these situations in the outdoors, there, you know, there was a book about, and I've talked about this a lot on the podcast. It was a lady, she was in her 60s, and her trail name was Inchworm, and she was hiking the AT, and her husband would, you know, drop her off and then pick her up at the next town. They'd kind of hang out, then he'd drop her off, and they were kind of doing the AT. She was hiking it, and he was just kind of, you know, just going along for the ride, and she got lost. The book is like, When They Find My Body, and so she ended up you know, had to use the restroom, got off trail, got lost. And I don't, it's like 3 or 4 years later, they actually found her body. I think the starting of the book, if I can remember correctly, talks about there, you know, a study done. And when you get into these types of situations that, you know, the very first decision that you make is so important that you get it right, because you can start on a path of right decisions or a path of wrong decisions. Mm-hmm. And you, I guess if you just think about it logically, you make the first decision wrong, and then at some point you're going to realize that that probably wasn't the best decision. And then that just, to me, I think kicks up the anxiety and stuff, versus you making a decision that you know, in mentally that's the right decision. And you, I think it starts to kind of calm you down a bit. But yeah, it's funny that you hear, even in hiking and backpacking, that's the one thing that is the most important, is to stay calm when you get into these type of situations.
Yeah, I think that, you know, from a hiking standpoint, since most of your listeners are going to be from that community, like the applicable response, I suppose, would just be to like, oh, I'm in a stressful situation that doesn't require that I do something immediately, right? Like, you know, like this doesn't apply to like a, you know, a grizzly bear walking at you or something like that. You do need to like figure that out immediately. But like, if the thought pops into your head that you're lost, right? That doesn't require an immediate response, right? And so giving yourself a moment to just like stop and sit down and notice, like, am I breathing irregularly? Like, you know, like get everything squared away, and then kind of like retracing your steps and figuring it out. You know, like there's other situations that happen in the mountains that kind of like are similar in that way, you know, where you just need a second to like just calm your nerves and just like think about it in a very objective, cold, calculated way.
So when you were telling me the story about you, John, and Megan, and even, you know, when they were talking about it, how do you manage hypothermia or exposure in cases when you're out in the middle of nowhere? And I think, you know, you had made the statement that I think both John and Megan were kind of getting into that state of hypothermia, and you as a guide and being responsible, like, how do you handle that?
Well, I mean, like I said before, like that's a pretty extreme situation, right? That's by no means like a regular occurrence at work. But, you know, I would just say that when it comes to hypothermia and just exposure in general, like you're just trying to avoid that. Don't let it start, right? So, you know, if you're wet, if you're starting to get cold, like it's kind of like a stop and fix situation, right? Once the problem with getting too cold is that you start to lose function. Like you actually you lose your dexterity. That's one of the first things to go. And in a climbing situation, if you start to lose dexterity, you know, your like actual physical movement starts getting wonky. Your ability to like operate the equipment starts to get wonky. And so it can really get bad quickly. And then as you get more cold, it actually impairs your like ability to think. And that's when you're starting to actually get hypothermia, is when like, you know, your body is essentially like, first it protects itself by shunting blood to things that are not vital, right? And then it's like, okay, we don't even have enough warmth to keep all of this stuff warm. So we're going to keep it, you know, we're going to take it away from your stomach and your kidneys or whatever, you know, like things that aren't like, you know, like your central nervous system and your heart essentially is like the last two things to shut down. But your brain also kind of like works in a similar way. It's like starts to like close in from, you know, the exterior parts of your brain. So you start to lose your judgment, ability to speak, stuff like that. So balance becomes an issue. So yeah, I mean, you really don't want to find yourself in that situation at all. And that's what I would definitely kind of guide your guests towards, you know, as far as an answer. But if you're, if you are in that situation, you need to get into a shelter of some sort. You need to get out of your wet clothes because they're actually like pulling heat from your body. If you can start a fire, like the John and Megan example is extreme in many ways, but also extreme in the sense that I actually, that was like the first time I'd ever started an actual fire. It was just purely like survival oriented. Like we got down to where we were going to camp off the glacier in the forest. And like, I like was like digging and finding like just like pieces of dry-ish wood. And then I, after like 2 hours of trying, I was able to make a fire. And I was able to dry all of our clothes. And like, once it was like a good bed of coals, I had them come out and stand around the fire and it really helped. But, again, that was a pretty extreme example.
So the key is to be proactive and don't let it get to that point.
For sure.
So looking back over your guiding career, have you ever had or was ever involved in a evacuation or rescue on the mountain?
Not directly. Nothing really comes to mind where I could easily be like, missing like a very like a thing that I should not be forgetting, but nothing is really popping into my head with that. I've been kind of like secondhand to rescue situations where I was kind of like a little bit lending a helping hand, but I'm not like in contact with rescuers. I'm not like, you know, creating, you know, rescue systems, you know, stuff like that. I've done things like, you know, like once, a lady stepped into a crevasse, and a lot of times they're like not very big. So they can be quite small, maybe 3 feet wide or less, where just your leg kind of like goes in. Right. But if you're walking downhill with a heavy pack and your foot breaks through the snow into a crevasse, and you've got that momentum, that's kind of like likely to hurt your leg. And in this case, it did hurt her knee. It was like a blizzard situation, like low visibility, high winds, lots of snow. And I just immediately recognized it as like, we don't have any bandwidth to like figure out what's wrong with your leg or like figure out if even you can walk or anything. We just need to like go. And so I just immediately pulled my rescue sled out of my backpack, which is essentially like a tarp with like some like attachment points and features that help you to like transport somebody that's injured. And I just wrapped her up and then came up with some weird way to, you know, because we're on a glacier, so we have to be all separated. So I just like put her in the middle of the rope team on this, you know, in this haul bag. And I just like dragged her for like 4,000 feet down the mountain. You know, so I guess that was like a rescue situation. But I think it might actually be that like when those types of things happen, I do just get pretty calm. And so I might be missing all sorts of crazy things I've been a part of that I like didn't really get too worked up about, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So what do you think is one mistake that can quickly turn a mountaineering route into a disaster? And the reason why I ask this question is I watch a lot of mountaineering documentaries, and to me, it's always, or it seems like it's always someone pushing that envelope against Mother Nature and weather. Oh, you know, we can make this little window, or, you know, let's do it. And, you know, the weather ends up winning. So what is your opinion on that? Or do you see like there's one mistake that, I don't know, that other guides or people in the mountains make that more often than not turns the day into a disaster?
Yeah, I would agree with you completely on that, actually. And I would just expand it to like, it's not just weather related. you know, I not to get too woo with you here, but like, I just genuinely feel that we have a sense, we call it intuition, but we have a sense that we have it as humans, and I think we just don't use it, right? So it has essentially become either it's like essentially underdeveloped. But I think that when you spend enough time in hazardous places, away from distractions that are constantly pulling your attention, you know, cell phones, things like that, I think that you actually can develop a heightened sense of it, you know, of intuition. People will refer to it as like mountain sense or like the voice of the mountain or stuff like that. But I have almost to a T every sticky situation that I've ever been a part of, there was some form of intuition occurring with somebody in the group, at least one person, that was essentially like either ignored or like you're like trying to push beyond it, like you were saying. You know, it's like, well, you know, I don't know about this slope, you know, and like, you know, if it's like an avalanche situation, it's like there's a part of you that knows that it's an unstable slope, just like internally, or maybe it's a subconscious thing or whatever. But like, yeah, it's this like voice that maybe doesn't have a voice. It might be more of like a feeling in your gut that something isn't quite right. And I would just say that whenever you feel that, you should honor it, or at least ask why you're feeling it. Stop and figure out what it is that you're missing.
And that leads to another question that I just now thought about. When that's going on, how often are you having the conversations with the client and they're like, no, like they have no experience probably really. And they're like, no, you know, it's summit fever, and they're no, come on, let's do it. Let's go. So how do you balance that?
You know, I think that like the biggest thing that you can do as a guide, to set yourself up for success in managing that type of situation is just laying down a really solid, like expectation, right? Like doing a really good job of managing expectations from like, hi, nice to meet you. Right. You know, I even include in my like pre-climb briefing, I might turn you around and I don't even necessarily know why. Like I might not be able to tell you why. I might just feel like something's not right and we need to go down. And like, you know, I just include that in the list of things that could turn us around. And I make everyone in the group like verbally agree to you know, hey, if Brandon needs to turn me around, we're going to turn around, you know? And like, yeah, it's a tough thing to manage for sure. But you definitely don't want to get into, like with some clients I've worked with a lot. And so it's part of their progression to like understand how these decisions get made. Right. Because everything in the mountains, like I'm not like a rule based person. Not when it comes to like decision making, not when it comes to like gear, not when it comes to like systems, like technical systems. Like I am not like you always do it this way with like pretty much anything. And I'm definitely of the opinion of like there are pros and cons to everything, right? There's like if you do this, you know, you're going to have this, you might sacrifice this, right? And so if it's a client where I'm working on their ability to make a decision, then I'll like discuss my thought process with them. But if it's like, hi, nice to meet you, I'm Brandon, we're climbing for the first time ever, we're on Mount Baker, I'm not going to, it's unnecessary for me to be disclosing all my thoughts. Like, they're focusing on enough stuff as it is, like walking in crampons for the first time, you know, like looking around at the crazy sights, and like, they're already on like system overload. The last thing they need is like all my thoughts. Right. But if I'm with somebody that I know can like handle everything that's going on, and then also like be thinking about like, hey, you know, how is Brandon managing this situation internally? You know, then I'll share.
Yeah, I bet you there would be a lot of interesting conversations to be had. And even we, you know, when we haven't done anything crazy, but when we go out hike and backpack, you know, we definitely talk through possibilities of things that can happen. How are we going to manage disagreements and stuff like that? Because, you know, those types of things are killers.
Yeah. You need to preload, you know, build it in, make everyone agree to it beforehand. And then the expectation is set.
So beyond your basic gear, is there any emergency gear that you always carry?
Like I said, I try and avoid always and nevers when it comes to this stuff. But, you know, there is, I don't know what you mean by basic stuff, but like I always have a med kit. You know, I always have some sort of a repair kit. The thing is that all of these items that I bring or potentially leave behind, they may adapt to the climb, right? And so you probably experience this with hiking where it's like, all right, this is going to be a quick day hike. Do I need, you know, my huge med kit, or could I bring like, I'm 3 miles from the car. Like, could I bring like a few Band-Aids and, you know, a tourniquet and a quick clot or whatever in case I run into somebody who's really in trouble. Maybe some epinephrine or something like that. But like, you know, like things like my kit is appropriate, or at least I try to make it appropriate for the objective, right? So if you're on like the AT or, you know, some big multi-week thing, that's a different kit than a 3-hour day hike, right? Then there's another element that's kind of more of a technical mountaineering climbing thing or skiing thing, where it's like, it might be quite difficult to move through the terrain that you're going to be in. And so, you know, for every ounce that you put on your body, you're making it more difficult to do the thing you're going to do. Right. So with everything you put in your pack, you're essentially diminishing your ability to move well. Right. And so you're trying to find this balance that. So, yeah, I guess that would be my answer, is like really look at your kit and make a conscious decision about whether or not you're going to bring it. And if you're not going to bring it, think about what the consequence of not bringing it is and be okay with that. And if you can't be okay with it, then it goes back in your pack.
Thinking about that question, I always make a joke. I never, ever brought a shell. Never, never.
Right. Texas, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. But you know, in the quads in the wintertime, you have snow, you have 80, 90, 100 mile an hour winds, you have hail, sleet, ice, you have it all. And I always just have layers and go, I don't need a shell. I don't need a shell. And then finally Henning taught me into it. He goes, just bring it. And it was a fairly sunny day, probably in the high 20s, low 30s, and I put the shell on, and it was the most magical thing I ever put on in my life.
Oh yeah.
and it was same thing when I was on Rainier with John, and I should have remembered that. I don't know if you would call it emergency piece of gear that used to never be a part of kind of the basic stuff that I carry, that now it's I don't care if it's 100 degrees. I roll that shell down and throw it in the backpack.
Yeah, in terms of layering, there's two items that really I have a hard time leaving behind, just because they're so light and they pack so small. Are like I have like a really lightweight. It's like a wind layer. It's like a windbreaker, but it's like it could help if it was raining a little bit, you know, and like a super light puffy. even if it's like a hot summer trip. Because it's just like those two things pack down to like the size of a softball, you know, and they can just live at the bottom of your pack, you know, and they don't weigh anything, right? So, yeah, those are two that hardly ever leave my pack.
So I was doing some research, and we may be getting into a little controversy, and I'm not talking about COVID or vaccines, but I'm talking about the state of the mountaineering industry. I was absolutely shocked that it would appear, and we'll definitely talk through this, that there does not seem to be any kind of regulation standards. I could right now start a company called JJ's Peak Bagging and start guiding on, I don't know, Mount Rainier.
Yeah.
And that was shocking. Kind of just to kick this off. And, you know, I definitely don't want to, if there's any questions that I ask that, you know, you would rather just not answer because of controversy or the guiding community, I absolutely respect that. But I just was absolutely shocked. And so what would you say are the biggest gaps or inconsistencies in how the mountaineering industry handles professional guiding today?
Well, you're absolutely right. There are no standardized credentials for what makes a guide, in this country. And, the example that you gave is, it's great that you said Rainier, because this is kind of a twofold thing. So not only, would it be possible for you to start a guiding service with no technical expertise at all and still guide technical terrain. But here's the catch. You actually couldn't do it on Rainier. And the reason you couldn't do it on Rainier is because essentially there is a monopoly for guiding permits on Rainier. So there are companies that can guide on Rainier, but they essentially, the national park won't hand out more permits, at least not in any sort of substantial amount. So it's like there's like a monopoly on some things, and then on the things that there isn't a monopoly on, it's just kind of like the Wild West.
Wow. And so are there currently any, I don't know, universal or widely accepted standards for becoming a mountaineering guide in the U.S.? I think you have a couple. And I guess is it limited to, what is it, the AMGA and the, what is it, IFM?
MGA.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, the AMGA is an affiliate of the IFMGA. So the IFMGA is like the International Federation of Mountain Guides Associations. So the American Mountain Guides Association is the American affiliate, right? And to my knowledge, it is the only guiding association that is recognized by the IFMGA in the U.S. And I think there have been a few kind of like startups over the years of like people trying to like have another system or have another like, you know, platform for that. But the only real like fully fleshed out guides association and training certification model is provided by the AMGA. And then in terms of like accepted credentials, typically guiding, it's a multifaceted issue in a lot of ways. It definitely kind of starts with the land managers. So whether it's the Forest Service, the Park Service, whoever, right? Whatever individual or group of people is in charge of managing X piece of public land, they essentially get to decide what the credential that is necessary, what is the credential necessary to guide here, right? And for most places, that credential is literally just like a woofer course, which is a medical training course. It's about a week long process, and you have to recertify that every couple of years over the course of a couple of days. But that has nothing to do at all with technical guiding. So again, like there is no like, yeah, it's very bizarre. It's a very, very, very bizarre thing to be like, there is no, when you say you're a mountain guide, it could mean anywhere from you've gone through a 10-year program with the AMGA to have professionals in the industry, longtime professionals, overlooking your work and making sure that like what you're doing is up to date, current, and safe. Or it could mean you literally have gone climbing a couple times.
That's nuts.
It's very, very bizarre. And I think that the average person, when they hire a guide, assumes that it's the first scenario, right? That this person is credentialed, right? Like when you go to a hospital, you're like, you're meeting a doctor and you're like, you don't question whether or not a doctor is a doctor. You're just like, this person says they're a doctor and they're in the right place, right?
Or a police officer or a firefighter or an airplane pilot or
an electrician or a, you know.
What is the nail tech?
Like people who work in like beauty salons have like a credential that they need to have to take you up this like very serious climb in the mountains. No credential necessary.
So I think we just probably answered this question, but maybe there's more to it. For someone outside of the industry like me, what do you see the differences between someone that says I'm a guide versus someone that says I'm a certified guide? Maybe I'll try to answer this and you can tell me if I'm right. If someone says they're a guide, that probably means they're not certified. That maybe means that they've spent some time outdoors, that they've taken a first aid class or a wilderness first aid class. And that does not mean they have any knowledge of the current mountain that they're guiding on. It doesn't mean that they've taken any classes on avalanche rescue or what are all some of the fancy things that you guys do? Avalanche and...
It's typically medicine, avalanche, and technical skills. Those are like the three categories that we're trained in and or certified in.
I mean, the guide may not even know how to tie a knot.
I mean, there is no minimum standard.
Jeez.
So yes, like the guide may not tie your knot correctly. The whole thing works in a very bizarre way. So typically guiding companies they have like a training or like a hiring system, right? And they have some sort of like an in-house training. And the in-house training could vary from quite good, you know, not like a replacement for like a third party looking over and being like checking on things and like going through this like, you know, very long, difficult process, not quite that good, but like pretty good, probably good enough to guide the objective. You know, a lot of things are guided in that way, right? Like a good example of that would be like most, the vast majority of the climbing that goes on, like on Mount Rainier, for instance.
Yeah, but just real quickly, what you just said, they're trained to guide the objective. And how many times does the environment call for maybe things that aren't the objective? You know what I'm saying? Like, I don't know if that makes sense.
No, totally. You know, and I think that there's a lot of pushback in the industry for getting that sort of like kind of more in-depth training, because it's like, well, hey, look at, we cover everything in-house that our guides need to guide this objective. And that seems logical until like shit hits the fan.
Yes.
Right? like, if anything really goes wrong and, like, you know, they're either off route or, like, they're, you know, in a storm or, like, somebody's got a broken leg and, like, some, you know, we need to, like, come up with some really complex system that's going to need to be made that's not just, like, your run-of-the-mill crevasse rescue, which gets practiced in these in-house trainings. But, like, there are a lot of things. And, like, there's a lot of pushback in the industry that, like, the standards for, like, actually going and getting certified are too high, which very much frustrates me as an individual, just because that's, like, completely against who I am. But the idea is, like, that the standard is too high and unnecessarily difficult to obtain. And so they just, like, don't do it. And they just, like, are not. If you go through a standard that, like, shows, like, okay, I can deal with all sorts of crazy things. Well, guess what? Now when, like, crazy things do happen, you're, like, much more prepared, right? Much more capable. Like, your ability to, like, problem solve is way, way higher.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And you just have more skills in your tool belt, right? It'd be like, a great example of this is like being a surgeon or a doctor, right? Like, I actually bet that you could teach somebody off the street to perform one or two medical procedures fairly quickly. Like, they do not need to go to medical school to perform. If it's just going to be two procedures that a doctor does and needs to go to doctorate school to become a doctor for, you could probably, like, actually, like, teach somebody to do that fairly quickly.
Yeah. Cut here, grab here, pinch here.
Yep. So here.
Like this.
Yeah. Yeah. I could probably learn that in, like, a couple weeks, actually. But, like, what happens if I, like, don't cut right there and I, like, miss? Or, like, what happens if I, like, if you, like, your anatomy is, like, a little bit different than what the last guy's was? Or, like, you know what I mean? Like, doctors are trained to a higher standard so that they can do whatever needs doing at the time, right? And so, like, this pretty quickly, this, like, idea of, like, in-house training that's really specific to the objective, it, like, doesn't really hold water, you know? Especially if, like, you know, this is a person with, like, a family, you know what I mean? Like, think of all the things that you hire a certified professional to do in your life.
Everything.
And then when you go and do, like, probably the most dangerous thing you'll do all year, that person isn't actually, like, you don't know exactly what that standard is that person's been trained at. And they don't hold, like, the internationally recognized credential for doing that. The problem is that 9 times out of 10, I would say that the person assumes that they are certified and just doesn't know that they're not. And there are, like, really tricky, like, marketing things that get done by the guiding companies that kind of, like, cast shadows on the whole thing and make it kind of difficult to understand, like, what it all is and what it all means. So it's very frustrating.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at every aspect of our life, we don't ask that question because people are certified.
Yeah, you know, there would be, like, legal, like, if you were, you know, an electrician, right? Or you said you're an electrician and you're not, right? And you wire somebody's house incorrectly and the house burns down, like, you're screwed, right? It's I'm not 100% sure, like, legally where we're actually at in terms of, like, you know, like the land manager said, all they had to be was this. And so, like, a guiding company could say, like, hey, we met the standard. Like, the Forest Service said, like, that our guides needed to be, like, a woofer and have, like, the first level avalanche course, right? That is intended for, like, casual recreational skiers and backcountry travelers, right? But I do think, man, I would have a heart. I think that if a person got injured on a climbing trip and you had a savvy lawyer and your guide wasn't certified or, like, trained to be guiding by the AMGA in the terrain that you're in, Whew, I think a savvy lawyer would kind of run away with that.
And all they need to do is go back and look at all the marketing.
Yeah.
What's the perception that they're putting out to the public?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's weird things with that too, you know, but.
Mm-mm-mm. And so I'm going to answer this question because I'm the public and you're the certified guide. Next question. Do you think there's a misconception among the public that all guides have a certification? Yes.
Absolutely.
I don't know that there's, that's what I'm going to do tomorrow at work when I have my Teams call and I have all my team members, all my developers and BAs. I'm going to ask them individually and I'm going to let you know the.
Please. Yeah. I'd be fascinated to know like what percentage of people would assume, you know, and just so you know, and everyone, all the listeners know, like, so the AMGA has, so I'm a full mountain guide is what they'll refer to me as, because I'm certified in all three disciplines, right? So rock, ski, and alpine. So they refer to me as a, you know, overseas, they might call me a full guide, a mountain guide, or just in some countries, just guide. Because if you don't have my credential in like a place like France, then you're not even like you can't do anything. Right. But in the US, we actually have like a discipline system. So it's like the rock ski and the alpine each have their own certification process. So like there's a lot of really great guides in America that are not full guides or mountain guides. They're rock guides or they're, you know, they're certified rock guides or they're certified ski guides or they're certified alpine guides, right? And they just, that's what they like doing and that's what they're good at doing and that's all they care about doing. So they're just certified in the thing that they do, which is completely fine. You know, if they don't have any plans to go to France, then you don't need to have your full guide done, right? And so like, you know, if you just like taking people rock climbing, there's no reason for you to be a ski guide. And so, you know, I would urge somebody hiring a guide to be like, okay, I get that you are a rock guide. Are you a certified rock guide with the AMGA? Is the question you would want to ask. And if they are a certified rock guide in the AMGA, they should be able to show some sort of proof, or the company should be able to provide you to like, hey, this is who we're going to send you out with. You can see their bio on the website at this link. This is who you'll be going out with, and you'll see it on the site.
Yeah, for sure. And so this kind of all leads to the next question. Have you, in your years of guiding, encountered situations where the in-house training or the lack of, I'm not going to say it's not a lack of proper training. As you said, they train for the objective. So where that wasn't enough or the oversight put people at risk?
Absolutely. Like I would say that happens on a regular basis and it takes two forms. There's like the really obvious, like crazy version where it's like, holy cow, someone is like imminently, there is some crazy shit going on over there. And like that guide and that team are not in the place that they should be in given, you know, the skills that they have. And then to me, the other version that it can look like, which I think is actually even worse, is like the blissfully unaware, right? The guide is unaware because they don't have like the training and experience to know that they're in a terrible situation doing a terrible thing. Of course, the clients are unaware. So it's just like, it just looks like to me from a distance, I'm like, oh my God, they're like, they don't even know the situation that they're in. And, you know, I'm not going to go into specifics with it because, you know, it's not necessarily the guide's fault. Like, I'll be honest, when I started guiding, I didn't have any credentials. No. I had a woofer, right? And that's all that the system required. But like I said before in the earlier interview, it's like, you know, I just, there were a lot of things I did not know yet. To be frank, there were people relying on me to know those things, you know? And like, mm-hmm. Luckily, I was fine, right? Yeah. But it easily could have been like, oh, I just didn't know. And the way that I found out was I had this accident.
If you see these situations, and let's say like at the end of the day, you guys all have a weekly debrief or end of the night debrief with the other guides. Are they receptive for you to come up and say, hey man, you know, I saw that, you know, you were tying the alpine butterfly backwards, or, you know, like, are they open to not criticism, but like help?
Feedback is tricky. I think that like some guides will take feedback willingly and openly and encourage it and whatnot. But, and there's some guides that don't really want to hear what they're doing wrong, and that's, you know, whatever. But I would say that unfortunately that there definitely is like a very competitive kind of edge, particularly like from one company to the next. So like, for instance, like if I'm guiding on Mount Baker, for instance, for one company, and I see a guide from another company doing something like, hey, like that was kind of iffy. It would be, I think, out of place for me to approach that person.
Yeah.
But if that guide was working for the company I was also working for, then for sure I would give that feedback. And that kind of goes along with this whole thing, which is like supervision. So like there are even provisions in place for like a guide that is not trained specifically to work at the, like, so the AMGA has for years been trying to implement what's called a scope of practice, right? Which is what you would kind of expect something like this would have, right? Like a doctor has a scope of practice, right? Like if you're an ear, nose, and throat doctor, you're not doing open heart surgery, right? You can do like basic doctor stuff, but like when it comes to like specialized things that aren't just like, you know, checking somebody's vitals and doing, you know, administering medications and stuff, then like you're going to stick to your specialty, right? In the AMGA, because there's like different stages in your development, like if you're going to be a rock guide, for instance, you might be like, might take one course. It's called a rock guide course. And then your next course is your advanced rock course. And then your next thing is going to be your exam. So each discipline has 3 or 4 stages within it. And so what the scope of practice would be like, if you've done this level, then this opens up this much terrain, right? And then if you're kind of going into terrain that you're not necessarily trained specifically to be in by the AMGA, then you would have to be working under the direct supervision of a guide that is certified to be there, right? So like I could take you out onto a glacier and be like, hey, let me watch you tie your clients in. Cool. Go ahead and tie your clients in. All right, sweet. Now spread everyone out, right? And I watch you spread everyone out and I like, okay, that. And then I'm like, hey, follow me. And then I guide my clients up and you're like directly behind me doing exactly what I do. And you might have only the specific training of like doing a crevasse rescue. And then all the decision-making and like complex things I kind of am overseeing, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
The problem with it is that there's been a lot of pushback in the SOP, the scope of practice. There's a lot of shady things that go down with it, and it is not working as intended.
So if guiding remains unregulated, what do you see, or what do you think the long-term risk to this profession is going to be, and the impact really to the clients?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately the clients lose the most. The other problem with it is that it keeps the career difficult to maintain. And so every year, the industry loses a decent amount of really experienced, highly trained professionals to go on to do other things. Because without the certification process, there's really like, you're essentially in a competition with a 20-year-old that is more than happy to do your job for half as much money as you're getting paid. And there's no like rule that says they can't. You know, so it, then if you're a business owner and you're like, well, I've got this one guide that's, you know, a 10-year guide here, and they have a certification, and I have this other guide that's on their rookie season, you actually have to weigh like, okay, am I going to put the certified guide out in the field for twice as much money, or could I get away with putting the rookie guide out there for way less money, so my profit will be much higher, right? So then it's just like you're weighing like, do I need a certified guide for this, right?
Yeah, and if there's no regulations, then and people are signing a waiver, I'm not going to say you're protected, but I mean the risk versus reward. If you know if you're not going to be sued or held accountable,
yeah, like I said, you know it. Like it might be that you would just say, hey, I met the minimum standards. It was like the law said I had to have this, like the federal government said I had to have this. But like, I do kind of wonder like if a lawyer wouldn't just totally have a field day with it, you know, if somebody were to get hurt.
Yeah. And it would be interesting to look at, I don't want to go back and look at tragedies, but to see when these things have happened, what has been the outcome legally with the people's families that, you know, something bad happened?
Yeah.
Well, I guess there's different levels, right? There's injury versus fatality. So.
Sure. You know, and there were some high profile accidents a few years back that resulted in like OSHA having a look, and I feel like OSHA like had a look and they were like, oh my God, I can't imagine, I can't believe what is happening here. And they just like, just went away. Like, I just like, they like had a look at the industry and then they were like, you all need to have personal protective equipment for bloodborne pathogens. And that was like the outcome of like a tragic accident that had nothing to do with that. You know, right now, to believe it or not, there's like a debate going on in the guiding community as to like whether or not guides are even working within the bounds of basic like employment law, right? So like if you're a guide and you're working in the field, how many hours did you work that day?
They put limits on truck drivers.
Well, sure, but like, if I were to say, hey, I need you to go out in the field and work this trip, you're going to meet the client at 7 a.m.,
mm-hmm.
and you're going to get up to camp, and you're going to set up camp up there, and you're going to sleep up there in case anything happens, right? Because the client the client could easily wake up in the middle of the night and be like, hey, I'm having a problem. I need you to help. And then you're going to like climb the next day. How many hours would you say that you worked that day?
Yeah, it would be every hour that I'm doing something. And think about it. If I'm sleeping, I'm still on call.
Absolutely. Like, I would argue that literally every hour, every minute that you are from like the trailhead. I mean, honestly, like there's some like preparing your equipment and everything even before you get to the trailhead. But like at a bare minimum, like from the trailhead to like the trailhead, that's like all of your hours worked. Yeah. Right. There's some, of course, some like shady interpretations and like, you know, it's just like, if you ask a layperson, like, what do you think? It's pretty unanimous. Like, oh yeah, that's this. But like, as soon as it like is talked about in the guiding industry, it's like, well, you know, and it's just like, here's what I ultimately think the problem is. There's a lot of guides that they're just happy with the status quo and they don't really need the industry to evolve to like make a living.
Yeah.
They just like the fact that they make a little extra cash, you know, working a few trips here and there, and like they don't need it to change because they don't need it for a living. It's like you've got a decent amount of guides that are like that. And then you've got a decent amount of guides that are brand new to the game. And they're like, please give me any work that is available and I will do it for $150 a day.
And so what do you think the reaction would be from the guiding community if the government came in and, because, you know, every state has different labor laws, but I think if the government came in and said, this is the baseline that everybody is going to have to follow. And then, of course, there will be, for every state that people are guiding in, maybe specific items for that state. What do you think the reaction would be from, in general, from the guiding community? Because usually when the government steps in, everybody's like, oh, don't tell me what to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think a lot of guiding companies are adamantly against that sort of a thing because they would have a hard time staffing some of their trips. You know, if the AMGA's like scope of practice became rule of law tomorrow, right? There would be like a lot of trips getting canceled that have been booked. There would not be enough. This is kind of the downside of the situation. There would not be enough trained and certified guides to meet the demand. And so that is essentially used as like one of the ways to justify what we're doing. But it's like, well, at some point you're going to have to just like pull the Band-Aid off if you want the industry to move forward. Like, well, there might be a season or two where it's like, yeah, we can't as an industry provide enough trips, but like that would also result in guides earning more. So you'd have more people migrating to the industry to be guides, right? There would just be like, it would correct itself. The only people who would lose out in the short term would just be the guides that are untrained and wouldn't be able to work trips for that summer. But more importantly, it'd be like the business owners. They would lose an enormous amount of money.
But I mean, maybe it could be not grandfathered in, but there'd be a grace period. Like, you know, you have 2 years to.
We've tried that. We've tried that.
Yeah.
Tried it, dude. It's like, like, you know, gonna do it. And they gave everyone like a number of years to be within compliance. And then the date came and like all of the big companies were like, well, we can't do it again this year. So we need to like get like, what do they call it? A variance. It's called a variance. So like they essentially write up like a variance to the scope of practice where it's like, well, you know, this company can do this route in particularly with untrained guides. And so it just like, it really just like takes the foundation out of the scope of practice, you know, when that happens. It just like completely chops out the whole foundation, the whole legs of it. So yeah, man, unfortunately, that's the state.
So as we've discussed and I've got to thinking, where do you stand on the scale, the argument of experience versus certification?
And that wraps up another exciting episode of the Trailblazing Texas podcast. We hope you enjoyed the episode today and stay tuned for our next episode where we will pick back up where we left off and guarantee to uncover many more hiking gems and share many more tips to enhance your experience on the trail. Until then, happy trails and happy hiking.